Bradford Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to confront a great irony. The fact that this great nation, the most powerful, the most influential, the most successful, the most consequential nation on planet earth, seems to be regularly threatened by a nightmarish, dysfunctional, totally backward society. The society known as North Korea. A country that is a brutal dictatorship that has never functioned properly, that actually inspires sometimes humor, sometimes horror, and very regularly fear. How did that come to be? How did this crazy society of North Korea come into existence? And why is it so afraid of the prospect of what is called a second Korean War? To understand all of that, you have to come to terms with the First Korean War, and that's the subject of this very special broadcast, Conflict in Korea, Remembering the Forgotten War. The Korean War is also known sometimes as the Unknown War. And it's amazing when you think about it that this enormously costly, very important conflict would be known and understood by so few Americans today. After all, it wasn't that long ago. The Korean War, of course, fought between 1950 and 1953. It was a conflict 5 years after World War II, and one of the reasons it is known as the Unknown War or the Forgotten War is because it's very difficult to categorize. It's not a glorious victory in total warfare like the World War II often is remembered. It's also not at all like the Vietnam War, where you had a very, very deeply unpopular war that resulted in victory for the enemy. The Korean War was very different. It was, for one thing, surprisingly popular for most of its duration, until the very end. It also involved some of the most colorful figures in all of human history. Not just the two presidents involved with the Korean War, but certainly them too. Harry Truman and Dwight D. Eisenhower, both very big, very fascinating figures. But General Douglas MacArthur, no more amazing personality in all of the annals of American military history. And also Joseph Stalin, who played a decisive role in the Korean War, and even Winston Churchill at the end. Plus, we're going to talk a little bit about a soon-to-be Catholic saint, an American soldier who served in Korea and now is a serious candidate for sainthood, and a saint of the sports world, somebody who was an incomparable sports hero who became an even more amazing battlefield hero in the skies over Korea during the war. Plus the term brainwashing. Brainwashing originated in the Korean War. We will cover all of that in this special broadcast. But one of the big questions and first questions is why this contribution of blood and treasure to the Korean Peninsula, so far away, such a relatively obscure part of Asia. The cost to Americans in the war was phenomenal. Officially, we had 33,629 battle deaths, but another 20,000, another 20,617 so-called non-hostile deaths. These were people who were missing in action, or people who died of illness or were frozen to death, or people, many of them, many thousands, who died in some of the most brutal prison camps ever designed by fiendish human beings. Korea has had a fascinating history and a very, very long history. Officially, Korea began as a nation 2,333 BC. And it began with an original ruler named Tangun. He was the son of the god of the heavens and a bear woman. It's all there in Korean legend. But even if you can't find a lot of archaeological evidence of Tangun himself, there is tremendous evidence of a Korean civilization often being one of the leading civilizations in Asia. The problem for Korea is it's been its location. It's in a tough neighborhood. On the one hand, it's right next to China, which is obviously a much more powerful, much more populous civilization always. It's also uncomfortably close to Russia. As a matter of fact, if you look at the borders of North Korea, there's even a little piece of it that borders directly on Russia, which has always been, or at least for 1,000 years, has been a very, very big factor in world affairs. And if you also take a look at the map, the Korean Peninsula comes uncomfortably close to Japan. And Korea, through most of its long, long history, developed its own civilization, its own language, its own culture, its own fine arts, literature, all of that, but usually under the shadow of China, Japan, Russia, or some combination of those difficult countries. Modern Korean history really began with the subjugation of the country by Japan, beginning in the late 19th century and culminating in 1910, the official occupation of Korea by the Japanese. Now, for whatever reason, Japanese people always seem to have held Koreans in very, very bitter contempt. And under Japanese rule, they made Korea into part of the Empire of Japan and industrialized it very quickly. But they also banned the use and study of the Korean language. They banned all Korean culture, and they forced, after 1939, everyone in Korea to use Japanese names. Much worse, they conscripted a huge chunk of the population when the World War II began into forced labor. It's unbelievable when you look at the numbers. 2.6 million Koreans out of a population of some 20 million combined population at the time. 2.6 million people were taken away for forced labor, and 723,000 were taken out of the country, not working for the Japanese in Korea, but largely working for them in Japan. In fact, an amazing statistic is that it's estimated that when the United States dropped its atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about 25% of the people who were killed were Korean slave laborers. Obviously, there was bitter, strong resistance to the Japanese efforts to try to stamp out Korean identity, to stamp out the Korean language. And two of the people who become very, very important in the story of the Korean War were both active in opposing the Japanese takeover, the Japanese brutality, unspeakable brutality against the Korean nation. And those two people were the dueling leaders of what later became North Korea and South Korea. One was an amazing person named Syngman Rhee. He was the strongman of South Korea. He was also always infatuated with the United States of America. And he began actively opposing Japanese rule. He was part of an independence club. He challenged the Japanese. He was arrested and tried for a sedition and for disobedience, and he was sentenced to life in prison. And while he was in prison, he became a Christian, and that changed his life. He began reading the Bible. Later, after he escaped from prison, he came to the United States. He got a master's degree from Harvard, a PhD from Princeton, studied theology, and became an official with the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, and later the strongman of Korea. Syngman Rhee, a substantial ego, not someone who respected a lot of democratic principles and procedures. He was someone who often would arrest and sometimes kill his political opponents. But he was notably and consistently pro-American. And when he was exiled at various times and for various reasons from Korea, including the very end of his life, after serving for a long time as South Korea's president, he always spent his time in the United States. He actually ended his life in Hawaii. The other individual was Kim Il-sung. Now, we don't know that much about Kim Il-sung except what the North Korean propaganda tells us. And in fact, they celebrate every year Day of the Sun in his honor. North Korean couples are supposed to bring flowers to one of his 500 statues before they get married. He took the name Kim Il-sung. That was not his original name, and it means Kim becoming the sun, or become the sun. Now, obviously, when somebody sees himself as the sun, it gets kind of hot for the people around him, and even for neighboring nations. We will get to that and more about America's role in this special broadcast, Conflict in Korea. It's from local dealers, autotrader.com, the ultimate new car marketplace. To try to understand the mood in the United States of America during the Korean War, it's worthwhile remembering the music that was most popular at that time. What you're listening to is Blue Tango by the great Leroy Anderson. And this was one of the number one hits that ruled the charts in 1951. So, by the way, is the Phantom Regiment, which is some of the music we're using as a theme for this special broadcast, Conflict in Korea. Phantom Regiment, also written in 1951 by Leroy Anderson, and clearly meant to evoke some of the pain and yet hopefulness and confidence and patriotism that rallied the country around the conflict in Korea. The conflict in Korea wasn't started by the United States of America. It was started by a guy called Kim Il-sung, whose real name was Kim Song-ju, but he took that name during his revolutionary phase. He actively fought against the Japanese long before World War II and then during World War II, and he also became a very committed communist, had training directly in Moscow. He claims, though there are a number of historians who doubt this, that he was raised in a Christian home and that his mother's father was, in fact, a Presbyterian minister. We don't know that, but he does say his father went to a missionary school and was an elder in the Presbyterian church. All of that is very surprising because here you have these two dueling leaders, one Syngman Rhee, who was very loyal and committed and fond of the United States of America, had his education in the U.S. and continually went back and forth to the U.S. Syngman Rhee and Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il was his worthless son, Kim Il-sung, both of whom claim to have been among the Christian community in Korea. But they became implacable enemies. And how did that happen? At the very end of World War II, at conferences in Tehran and then conferences in Yalta, Franklin D. Roosevelt made deals with Joseph Stalin. And what Roosevelt wanted Stalin to do is, after the war ended in Europe, because it was clear that Germany was going to fall before Japan, Roosevelt wanted Stalin to turn his battle-hardened troops against the Japanese. And in order to do that, there basically were deals that were made. And one of those deals, which was drawn up initially by Colonel Dean Rusk, who later went on to become Secretary of State under John Kennedy, was that the Russians would occupy the Korean Peninsula up to the 38th parallel. It's a line on the map, fairly arbitrary, chosen by Colonel Rusk. And the Americans would get a chance to occupy the country south of the 38th parallel. And when, at the very end of the war, when the war was over in Europe, and when finally Stalin belatedly, after some U.S. prodding, did turn his attention against the Japanese and their positions in Manchuria, sure enough, the Russian troops occupied the northern part of Korea up to that line. And amazingly, they stopped there. Stalin kept that agreement. He didn't keep all his agreements. He didn't even keep that many of his agreements. He kept that one. And then the Americans actually came in later, and eventually the Americans had 45,000 troops at their peak in Korea. But the idea was that the two nations who had been allies in fighting the Germans, and very briefly allies in fighting the Japanese, the idea was that these two nations would cooperate and would help to achieve a united Korea. The problem was that Stalin's idea of the Korea that he wanted was very different from Harry Truman, who had taken over the presidency after Franklin Roosevelt died in April 1945, Truman's idea of the kind of Korea he wanted. And the Cold War had already been launched in earnest, primarily in Europe. There was struggle between the communists and between the free world over Greece, increasing struggles concerning Iran, which at the time, even then, people knew was going to be important for its oil supply. There was a blockade of Berlin and a Berlin airlift, the occupation of a whole number of Eastern European countries by Stalin and by the Russians. Churchill gave his famous speech about an Iron Curtain descending across Europe. And then, worst of all, the Soviets exploded an atom bomb. The United States had felt that we would be safe against any potential challenger because we had this amazing weapon, and we were the only country that had it. But in 1949, the Russians exploded an atom bomb, and meanwhile, they also succeeded in conquering China. The Russian client, Mao Zedong, and the Chinese army beat the American-supported forces of the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek. And this was considered, of course, a great disaster, because even though China had been ravaged and largely destroyed during the war, people knew this was one of the most populous countries on Earth and had a prominent future. So there was a general sense of a Cold War going on, a struggle for influence, a struggle for supremacy. And part of what happened was that that meant that it was not possible to get the two sides to agree in Korea on holding national elections. So Kim Il-sung becomes the dictator of North Korea. Ultimately, he is credited, if that's the right word, with murdering over a million of his fellow citizens in North Korea in concentration camps. And that's beyond the casualties in the Korean War, which also may have reached a million people, which is astonishing in a small country. Syngman Rhee had his own disregard of democratic norms, but he was elected by the Korean Assembly. And he became the president of what was called the Republic of Korea, which was South Korea. And these two rival nations, each claiming to represent all the Korean people, sort of frowned and snarled at each other across the 38th parallel. This continued with America feeling increasingly threatened by the Russian conquest, the communist conquest of China, the Russians exploding a bomb. There was all kinds of hysteria in the United States, and appropriately so, about communist penetration of U.S. institutions, including the State Department. One of the most influential diplomats in America, Alger Hiss, was revealed in a long and complicated case to be an active communist. Joseph McCarthy was making his initial claims. The United States was worried, and there was a general sense that America was being thrown back on its heels. The big worry for all planners was Japan, because Japan obviously had the potential to be a world power economically, militarily, and Japan had begun to recover under the leadership of Douglas MacArthur, who was a virtual, not dictator, but he was the man in charge in Japan. Why was the invasion of South Korea such a threat to Japan and to the United States? We will get to that and more in this special on this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, Conflict in Korea. The road to war was paved at least partially by the pages of two speeches, one of them very famous and one could say infamous, and the other, little known, but very stirring and very important. The first of the two speeches was by the Secretary of State for Harry Truman, Dean Acheson. And Dean Acheson, though he was attacked by Republicans regularly as being a communist sympathizer, was actually somebody who was very involved in helping to build up NATO, helping to build the strong American response to the Soviet threat in Europe. And on January 12, 1950, just a few months before the Korean War began in June of that same year, He gave a speech to the press club in Washington, D.C., which was built up by the administration, which he sketched out what he considered to be the American defense perimeter, and talking about those nations that America would defend. And what was very striking in the speech was that he excluded South Korea, which was our ally, which was struggling to establish itself. And he not only excluded South Korea, he also seemed to exclude Taiwan and Indochina, the future Vietnam. Now, we know historians have found that Stalin read this speech very carefully. He said, let's see, the Americans say, why did Acheson say all this? And the basic point was that what Acheson was saying was that the United States put the biggest priority in defending Europe. Europe was facing all kinds of challenges, big communist parties in Italy, big communist party in France, divided Germany, obviously, with Soviet tanks right coming up to the border of the West. So the focus was all on the West and not so much in Asia. And this is after, of course, the communists under Mao Zedong had taken over in China. The other speech seemed to contradict Dean Acheson's speech. Dean Acheson was Secretary of State, also working in the State Department, was a rather remarkable American diplomat, fascinating guy named John Foster Dulles. His grandfather had been Secretary of State. He had another uncle who had been Secretary of State. He was born, bred to be a diplomat. He was a Republican. He later became Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. But Dulles was considered to be the chief Republican advisor in a State Department at a time when they still considered bipartisan foreign policy very important. And he spoke to the Korean parliament, the new parliament in South Korea in Seoul. And he said this: "The American people welcome you as an equal partner in the great company of those who comprise the free world, a world which commands vast moral and material power and resolution that is unswerving. Those conditions assure that any despotism which wages aggressive war dooms itself to unutterable disaster. The free world has no charter, but it is no less real for that. Membership depends on the conduct of a nation itself. You are not alone. You will never be alone so long as you continue to play worthily your part in the great design of human freedom." And the Korean parliament rose to applaud these stirring words. Of course, it's wonderful to hear that you're not alone, but the United States had left them pretty much alone. One time we had 45,000 troops in Korea. They were all withdrawn. Budgets were savagely cut. I mean, dramatically cut. The Republicans in particular in the Congress of the United States, they took control of Congress in the earlier part of the Truman administration. Then they lost it again in 1948. But they were pushing for lower and lower defense budgets. And as a result, the 45,000 troops we had in South Korea were cut down to 500. We also did nothing to equip the South Korean army with the kinds of planes and tanks and big guns that the North Koreans had. And what happened was on the night of the 25th of June of 1950, there was a massive attack, actually three major prongs all along the 38th parallel from North Korea to South Korea. They claimed that it was based upon some kind of South Korean skirmish where the South Koreans had gone over the perimeter line. Nobody really believes that. But all of a sudden, President Truman, who was home visiting his family in Independence, Missouri, he'd had a nice dinner. It was a Saturday night. He was relaxing after dinner, and he got a fateful phone call. What did the phone call say, and what did Truman say? More to the point, we'll get to that and more this special broadcast.
To purchase this special show, go to...
Thrust unexpectedly into the presidency by the death of Franklin Roosevelt, is home on Saturday night in Independence, Missouri, in a modest home, his modest family home. He's with his wife and his mother-in-law and extended family. They've just had a relaxing weekend dinner, Saturday evening dinner. And Truman apparently hadn't gone to bed. A number of the family had. The phone rang at 10 o'clock. It was the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson. Truman noticed immediately that it was 10 o'clock. It was even later than that in Washington, D.C. And Acheson said immediately, "Mr. President, I have very serious news. The North Koreans have invaded South Korea." The president paused for a moment, immediately asked, "Can they hold the line?" Meaning the South Koreans. They had an army of about 100,000. The United States had not given them the tanks and the planes they wanted because the United States had thought the main purpose of that army would be to deal with guerrilla warfare and local insurrection in South Korea. They never expected that there would be this kind of full-scale invasion. Acheson said that the South Koreans appear to be crumbling within hours of being overwhelmed by a much larger, better-equipped force. Truman paused again for a moment, and then he reportedly said, "Dean, we've got to stop the sons of bitches no matter what." The president then acted accordingly. And it may seem surprising, but they took the matter immediately to the United Nations. The United Nations, newly created with great hopes, they took it to the Security Council to get a resolution to authorize an international police action to stop the invasion of South Korea. Now, what chance was there? Because Russia had a veto. Except here's one of the ironies. Russia was boycotting the Security Council. They were refusing to attend Security Council meetings. Why? Because China had been taken over by the communists, but the communist Chinese were not given a seat on the Security Council. So Stalin had basically said, "We don't come to the Security Council with no Chinese." Okay, so they didn't come. So basically, Russia, which could have vetoed the resolution, wasn't there. They were in the midst of this boycott. And the Security Council voted unanimously to authorize a war. Everyone knew that the United States would carry the bulk of the fighting. And in fact, 88% of the people who fought under United Nations command in Korea were American. And one of the big assets that America had is one of our most phenomenal war heroes, Douglas MacArthur, was there in Japan, commander of a whole series of titles that he held in the army, and also basically running affairs in Japan. He was responsible for the reconstruction of post-war Japan. And by the way, this is the most magnificent success of his whole career. He did a phenomenal job and remains to this day very popular in Japan. Douglas MacArthur is immediately named by Truman to be head of the UN police action in Korea. And to get some of the president's thinking and the way that he appealed to the American people, his actions were widely praised across the board. The New York Times, which had been dismissive of Truman, praised him. And he also received praise for a speech that he gave about 3 weeks after the invasion of South Korea. And it's a radio address explaining why the UN had been so strong in authorizing this fight.
52 of the 59 countries which are members of the United Nations have given their support to the action taken by the Security Council to restore peace in Korea. These actions by the United Nations and its members are of great importance. The free nations have now made it clear that lawless aggression will be met with force. The free nations have learned the fateful lesson of the 1930s. That lesson is that aggression must be met firmly. Appeasement leads only to further aggression and ultimate war.
That's Harry Truman in a radio and television address from July 19th, 1950. Of course, more people would have heard it in 1950. On the radio than on TV, because TV was still a relatively recent development. Truman concluded his speech with the kind of appeal to God that the ACLU then let pass, but today would obviously condemn.
"We know that the cost of freedom is high, but we are determined to preserve our freedom, no matter what the cost. I know that our people are willing to do their part to support our soldiers and sailors and airmen who are fighting in Korea. I know that our fighting men can count on each and every one of you. Our country stands before the world as an example of how free men under God can build a community of neighbors working together for the good of all. That is the goal we seek, not only for ourselves, but for all people. We believe that freedom and peace are essential if men are to live as our Creator intended us to live. It is this faith that has guided us in the past, and it is this faith that will fortify us in the stern days ahead.
One of the perspectives on the Korean War was actually provided by that same John Foster Dulles, who gave that stirring speech to the Korean Parliament, promising that they would not be alone. And a month before the attack, 2 weeks before he gave that speech, he reviewed the situation in the Far East. He wrote a memo on the declining U.S. strategic position. The situation in Japan may become untenable, he wrote, and possibly that in the Philippines. Indonesia, with its vast natural resources, may be lost, and the oil of the Middle East will be in jeopardy. None of these places provide holding grounds once the people feel that communism is the wave of the future. But this series of disasters can probably be prevented if, at some doubtful point, we quickly take a dramatic and strong stand that shows our confidence and resolution. Probably this series of disasters cannot be prevented any other way. We'll be right back.
Which way is even easier?
That's Patti Page, The Singing Rage, with her song The Tennessee Waltz, which was a number one hit for 3 months, dominated the charts as a single at the time that the United States made the decision to go to war in Korea. The country would have much preferred to waltz away the time and to concentrate on rebuilding after World War II, people going back to civilian life. Most people had never even heard of Korea at the time that the North invaded and Truman went to the UN and got approval for a U.S. mission. 88% of the troops were U.S. troops. But what's astonishing when you go back and you look at what happened was the way the country rallied behind Harry Truman, including Republicans who had been deeply, deeply critical of the administration for having lost China. The kind of enthusiasm, the leading Republican newspaper in the country was the New York Herald Tribune, and they had a front page editorial that declared, "The president has acted and spoken with a magnificent courage and terse decision. It was time to draw a line somewhere, somehow." And in the Senate, when the Democratic leader, Scott Lucas of Illinois, was speaking and answering some criticisms from some of the doubtful Republicans, and the Senate was very closely divided, William Noland, who was a rising figure in the conservative wing of the Republican Party in the Senate at the time, got up and he said, "I believe that in the very important steps the President of the United States has taken to uphold the hands of the United Nations and the free peoples of the world, he should have the overwhelming support of all Americans, regardless of their party affiliation." Both sides of the Senate broke into loud, sustained applause, stood up, and cheered. The problem, of course, was that the battlefield situation was grim. And the nation, however, could take comfort in the fact that one of our most decorated, most famous, most legendary warriors would be the man who would become Supreme UN Commander and lead the U.S. forces in Korea. His name was Douglas MacArthur. And MacArthur and his relationship with Harry Truman became a huge theme in determining what occurred ultimately with the conflict in Korea. They had very, very different ideas. Harry Truman believed limited war. You must at no cost risk Europe or risk bringing Russia into the war or China into the war. MacArthur, he believed no substitute for victory. The way that their relationship played out of two strong-willed men who, by the way, had never met when this war began, that relationship and that story is part of what makes the history of this particular conflict so compelling. We will return with conflict in Korea and what it means to this greatest nation on God's green earth.